Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
It is finally spring in Chicago, and I'm sitting with a colleague and friend from the University of Chicago Divinity School who has successfully, chapeau bas, published a book which is called A Revolutionary Faith, Liberation Theology Between Public Religion and Public Reason. The book has come out this year in a very prestigious series edited by Hen de Vries, called Cultural Memory in the Present, and at Stanford University Press. And you are in an incredible company when I look at the other publications in this series. It's rather incredible. So congratulations, Raoul. This is a great accomplishment. Because many dissertations are written, but not many are published. Sometimes it takes much more effort to turn a dissertation into an actual publication. Before talking about the book, I'd like to ask you to speak about your personal intellectual and spiritual journey, and how did you get to the point of writing this book. And I think your personal story is relevant to this. But so I met you several years ago when you came from University of Notre Dame to study at the University of Chicago Divinity School. And I think we've taken also some classes together. But anyway, to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for this invitation. And to be in this, pod is a very, very enticing experience to be in the New Books Network. So I guess I say something about myself, then we can get into this material as much as we want. But as you know, well, I'm from Peru. I'm a South American who happened to end up be in the U.S. for grad school, but I was born in Peru, raised in Peru, and I really stayed in Peru until I was 26 or so when I came to the U.S. for grad school. Peru's a country which, has many different features. One of them is a very, Catholic country that's changing all of it. And there's also a country that is very much marked by poverty and inequality. And I think those two things were always kind of in the background of my own intellectual journey in some fashion. When I finished high school, I wasn't really sure what to do. I knew that I was, somewhat, skilled with, reading, writing, things like that. And people suggested I should become a lawyer, which I seriously considered. And then I went to the Catholic University of Peru, the Pontifical Catholic University of Peru, PUC, as we call it. And I just started exploring, kind of my gen ed classes in the first 2 years. And I became fascinated by the humanities, history, sociology, anthropology, you know, philosophy, ethics. All this really was a new opening of possibilities for me. I come from a working class family with a few entrepreneurs, but seriously no academics at all. And I mean, there were no many books in my house. So this was like a set of options that were not really available to me when I was growing up. And then in that process of trying to decide what to do, thinking I'll become a lawyer, but being exposed to all these things, it became increasingly clear to me that I wanted to pursue a path that was more fulfilling to my own intellectual journey. So I decided to study philosophy, and I did my BA in philosophy, and I did a master's in philosophy as well before coming to the US. And this was a department of philosophy that was heavily shaped by the traditions of phenomenology and hermeneutics. It just happens to be the case, as a matter of fact, that this department had students of Martin Heidegger, Jacques Derrida, Jürgen Habermas, Richard Rorty. It was a phenomenal department, you know, in the midst of nowhere in some ways. But I got interested in American pragmatism, actually. So I got this kind of education of hermeneutics and phenomenology, but what drew me to pragmatism was this kind of problem-solving approach to philosophical issues and the interest, especially of William James, in religion. And these started to become something very important to me, the dimension of the practical, the dimension of religion. And in this process, because Peru, and especially the Catholic University of Peru, was kind of the intellectual, I guess, cradle, the think tank of liberation theology in some ways, I became acquainted with the work of Gustavo Gutierrez. And then this became essential for me, a combination of this kind of philosophical education and interest in the practical and experience, and the dimension of experience also and practice with liberation theology, but also the question of social justice. So this is kind of the, I guess, academic background that brings me to the U.S. You cannot really study religion very well in Peru. There is no schools where you can do serious academic study of religion. So I came to the U.S., did the master's in Notre Dame, worked with Gutierrez, was a professor, and I worked very closely with him, and then went to the University of Chicago to complete my theological studies.
Yeah, and these trains, the philosophical and theological / practical, are very obvious in your book, because what I find fascinating in the book is the way you bring together these various trains, right, and various voices. You use clearly the theological framework, David Tracy, Hans Joas, but then you also at the end bring in the philosophical framework, John Rawls and Martha Nussbaum.
So since liberation theology is the focus of this book, would you mind briefly going over the background and history of liberation theology and how it arose and why you chose to write about it and why your approach is somewhat different? I mean, I noted earlier one difference that I observed is the variety of lenses that you use in the book, which is fascinating. Please.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's there's so many ways to get at this question, and there is a lot of good work that has been done on it. So what I have done in the book a little bit, and I'll try to do here briefly, is try to develop a typology of what I see as the main elements of all liberation theologies, if you will, not assuming that these typologies, you know, complete or exhaustive, but I think set something. And then what I do to be more accurate is follow the process of the specific trajectory of Latin American liberation theology and the specific work of Gustavo Gutierrez and some of the people working with him. And I think that's what I'll do right now. I say this because, of course, there is plenty of discussions about the relation between, you know, Latin American liberation theology and Black liberation theology, or feminist, which is a form of liberationist theology. So I'll try to focus this on the case of Latin America, Peru, and Gutierrez, just for the sake of accuracy. As I also say in the book, trying to be, I think, too expansive about these also risks inaccuracy. And I discuss some of the accounts that I find a bit inaccurate in some occasions. So let me say something quick about what I take to be the four main features of liberation theology. One thing that I think is essential is what I call the radical opposition to all forms of oppression. I think this in Latin America starts with a sense of the opposition to the oppression that people experience through poverty. But then this over time expanded to become a movement that thinks about liberation in terms of questions of gender, of questions of race, of questions of the environment, and so on. The second point is that I think that liberation theology should be always conceived of as a movement of solidarity with and among the oppressed. And this is a movement of solidarity that seeks emancipation, liberation. So a key element here then is what I call the agency of the poor, right? This is not just about people telling people experience poverty what to do, but it's something that really emerges out of the experiences of poverty and trying to organize and do something about them. This is in the context of Peru in the 60s and so on. The third issue that I think is very important is that liberation theology, and this might be one of the key innovations, thinks about the question of poverty from a structural institutional perspective. So there is a shift, I would say, from charity to faith-based advocacy for systemic change. This is, I think, a massive difference with prior historical concerns with the poor and poverty, which is here we're saying, yes, of course, you know, the poor are blessed, you know, God loves them. There's also something about the systems we inhabit that can be changed. And this is also part of the calling of Christian discipleship in the context of Christianity. And the fourth element is that this is a theologically or religiously committed movement. And this is essential because the three first features I described can very much be found in other movements of liberation. But the fact that this is a faith-based movement, struggle for liberation, that is seen as a central component of people's faith, is a decisive contribution of liberation theology. And in the case of Gutierrez, which is the case I study the most in this book, this is about how people are able to articulate their experiences of injustice and able to provide a response to them that is both faith-based but politically active in different ways, by the way. But I'll leave it there for now.
Thank you, Raul. And what I find fascinating, before I come to more questions about this, is what you say in the introduction. I mean, your desire to find a niche or a space in the conversation about social justice for, as you say, faith-based solutions or responses. And it seems to me you're reacting against a certain type of secularist exclusivism that doesn't seem to take, let's say, theological ideas and responses seriously.
Well, I guess, yes, but I'll add a caveat, right? Because there is different traditions that respond to the perceived threat of secularism. And I would not like to be placed together with some of them, because one of the things that I tried to do in the book is actually show that the historical process of secularization, that, by the way, should be at least thought as a threefold process, as in the work of Jose Casanova, right? So differentiation of the spheres of, let's say, religion and the political or church and state, if you will, that's one element. And then you have the idea of the decline of religion and the idea of the privatization of religion, right? These are three elements of the historical process of secularization that don't actually come together very often, right? And this is important because liberation theologians, at least in my account, but I think the account is correct, are not opposed to the first element. They're not opposed to the separation of the affairs of the church and the affairs of the state. As a matter of fact, they are very much for it, and I make an argument about this in the book, because this allows them, and Charles Taylor has a similar perspective in his text Catholic Modernity, allows them to disclose new, or I guess, features of the gospel that were there in principle, but were not, you know, really materialized in history because of the unification almost of the interests of the church and the state for centuries, right? So all this is to say that with liberation theologians, or at least this is my interpretation, I am not against secularization, and actually I favor very much this separation. And in that sense, what this book is about and what this book's response to is to certain forms that assume that you have to completely get rid of religion in the public sphere to be able to have, you know, a healthy democratic living. And what the book argues, and I'm the only one, of course, there, is that it is very important to separate the first of the church and the state, but that's very different from saying that religious people, people of faith, cannot participate of the political or the public sphere. And that's a very important difference, I believe. And to just mention maybe some school of thought that is very different, even though initially may seem similar, this is very different, for instance, from radical orthodoxy or something like that, right? It's a very different take, just for the sake of a counterpoint.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. How and why is it different? And just before you answer this, you said that religious people participate. I would have asked you immediately, as religious people?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, let me start with the second question. The question with as religious people, I think, is crucial, right? And the book, especially chapter 3, I hope is very clear in terms of how people very obviously, very clearly reason through their participation in politics, right? Kind of in a process of really a spiritual discernment of what are the stakes, you know, and how they find in their tradition, in the Christian tradition in this case, resources to think about how to participate and organize in the political, right? By the way, I received a question about this the other day in a presentation about the book, and I found the question very, very interesting. This does not mean, even though the title may suggest otherwise, that all the forms of participation in the political are revolutionary in the sense of, you know, like starting a guerrilla or something like that. That was really very rarely the case, as a matter of fact. But what this kind of approach of liberation theology did is allow people to think religiously about multiple forms of intervention in the political. Many of them were just, you know, marches, protests, you know, organizing, community organizing, things like that. Very rarely this had anything to do with revolutionary attempts in the more standard sense of the word. But my point is that the key element here is that they think about this through the resources of the Christian tradition. And really explicitly, this is shown in some of my interviews and the material in chapter 3, they think about this from the perspective of faith. They're not naive. They know strategy. They know community organizing. But, you know, this is very important. On the other issue, I think that the key difference is that there is no sense, let's put it this way. Often in radical orthodoxy and other approaches that are very critical of, let's say, secularization, modernity, and all that, there is a sort of sweeping statement about what modernity is, or what the secular is, or what the Enlightenment is, and things like that. And I believe that liberation theologians, at least Gutierrez, or at least in my account, are a bit more sophisticated in the way they think about these processes. So there is multiple modernities, there is multiple secularizations, there is different forms in which this affects different regions in different historical moments. And then there is elements of these that are worth rescuing, and there are elements of these that are worth criticizing. And making those distinctions is very important, right? So that you can say, as I did before, that you can favor the separation of church and state as something that is ideal and fosters better democratic living in a pluralistic society like the US, but most of ours, right? And on the other hand, you can oppose the idea that you have to silence religious voices in the public sphere, which, by the way, very few people actually believe, even modern philosophers, but there is that idea sometimes in the mind of some people. So that's, for instance, one example. The other one would be that I think that there is often an idealization of what the church can do as an alternative polis, an alternative community. And I think liberation theologians are very attentive to the corruption of the church, and then are able to be critical of the failures of the church without thinking that we have to just get rid of the spiritual community the church represents, right? So what I see in liberation theology, and I think this is partly because they took in a very intelligent and critical way some of the intuitions of the critique of religion of Marx and others, is that they were able to incorporate some of the constructive elements of the critique without getting rid of everything. And I think that's something I value a lot in liberation theology.
Wow, where to start? I mean, maybe we can start, it's a good moment to talk about the critique or the of liberation theology that has come from, let's say, the traditional voices within the church, represented especially by Cardinal Ratzinger and the two documents that were issued in 84 and 86, right? And so can you speak or address some of the quote-unquote accusations or critiques that were brought towards liberation theology, right? One is that it's an uncritical borrowing of Marxist ideology, that it politicizes the tenets of the faith, right? And that somehow it reduces everything, or it reduces the issue of poverty and inequality to political issues.
Gladly. I mean, this is something that has been very, very well studied, so I'll say something brief. And in some ways, the book is an attempt to respond to some of these critiques without necessarily naming them, although I think I referred to them at some point. But, where to start? I think that anybody who's familiar with Vatican documents, especially critical documents that put forth a critique of theologians or ideas that are perceived, you know, as held by certain theologians or theological currents. Everybody who are familiar with this, I'm saying, knows that these are often like very vague documents that rarely have citations, you know, rarely really focus on specific nuances, and they just perceive a problem and utter a critique. So In that sense, it's understandable. There was a fear, you know, that in this emerging, you know, social movement in Latin America, especially, there was a reduction of religion to politics. There were other elements of the critique. For instance, one, I don't remember in which of the documents, but is the idea of the creation of this other church, the church of the poor, and that creating a sort of schism within the church and things like that, right? You know, as a general concern, sure, right? The problem is that this is so inaccurate as an account of the work, at least of most liberation theologians. So one of the things I do in the book is try to show, I think, abundant evidence that this was not the case, that at least the people I study in my book were very clearly not reducing religion to politics. And as a matter of fact, not reducing politics to religion either. Right, they were very clear. That's a concept I use a lot in the book, that comes from the work of Charles Taylor and Hans Joas is the notion of articulation. What you see in the book and what you see in the work of Gutierrez and in the experience of the people of faith that are non-theologically trained but are shaped by theological ideas is this process of articulation of religion and politics. They're trying to figure out how being religiously honest, you know, being in conversation, genuine dialogue with the tradition, they can also go beyond what at that point was the standard assumption of how Christians are supposed to participate in politics, go beyond that to make an intervention that was more active and more transformative. But all of this is reasoned in conversation with the tradition. It's never just saying, oh, you know, like I'm Marxist and I don't care about Christianity anymore. No, they struggle with it. And the articulation of that struggle, finding the balance between, okay, I have certain political commitments, but I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe in my church was essential. But in the process of finding this balance, in the process of articulation, there is also the development of critique. And there was a critique of, you know, certain historical complicities of the Catholic Church in Latin America with the status quo. That didn't mean, as the Vatican document suggested, that they were trying to develop a new church or a different church. But it meant that there was a sense that the historical complicity of the church with colonialism, you know, with some of the abuses of the hierarchy and so on, was acknowledged, was seen as problematic, and there was a call for renewal and for, you know, owning in a more, I guess, authentic way the core values of the gospel. So I'll say that this was the key difference. And I think in that sense, the documents, as often happens with documents, show a concern, but in terms of how much they are right on target, they were not.
As I hear you speak, I think maybe the notion of revolution or social change that liberation theology intended or expected was misunderstood. And I think there are, I found several passages in the book, for example, in the chapter Tradition in Revolution, page 41, where you provide very important qualifications about what revolution means. Would you mind maybe citing the very last two paragraphs of 41, Raul? Or rather comment on them?
Yeah, do you want me to read them? I can read them quickly.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, just to hear your voice a little bit from the book.
Very good. Okay, this page 41. I take this point to be of great importance in two respects. I'm commenting about, you know, how Gutierrez balances questions of faith and questions of politics. Okay, so I return. I take this point to be of great importance in two respects. First, it stands as a cautionary remark. No effort to bring liberation to our historical realities should ever be understood as final. This especially powerful word of caution against ideological cooptations of the message of Christian liberation that attempt to identify this process with the agenda of some political project. Instead, this catalogical horizon makes the believer more contingency conscious and perhaps humbler in regard to the depth of the transformations that can be produced. Second, this is also an invitation to remain hopeful. No human action can produce the kind of transformation we would like to see realized. Yet, the believer may indeed have faith that for God nothing is impossible. Such belief can become a source of nurturing and strength, especially in the context of repression and death that often accompanies the struggle for liberation. As you will see in subsequent chapters, such faith has been a key component in the activism of liberation theologians and lay people who have remained committed to the preferential option for the poor, even under the most dangerous, pressing, and disheartening circumstances.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. And if I may just add the previous, a few lines from the previous paragraph, where you say, that alone makes liberation a worthy goal. The same should be said about the struggle against oppressive structures, the first level. However, in Gutierrez's view, that is not enough, at least not from a theological viewpoint. In Christian theological terms, true liberation is salvation in Christ, in whom all history is recapitulated. Therefore, the process of historical liberation, of the struggles for emancipation and freedom, should be inserted within the larger, single, but complex process of the divine creation and recreation. And this paragraph precedes what you just read. I think this is a very important qualification because it shows how political processes and political involvement, as I understand, has to be always reconducted or retraced to, let's say, the message of the gospel or the manifestation of it, which was manifested in Christ. And then you go back to the political action, so to speak. So it's a back and forth, as I understand it, not a divorce between the two horizons, so to speak.
Yeah, very much so, or at least for, you know, the work of liberation theologians. Right? Another thing that is important to me in this regard is that even though this is very true about people influenced by liberation theology, at least in the context I study in Peru, another very interesting feature of this is that because these people are committed to both, you know, this theological, eschatological understanding, but also to real transformations in the concrete, right? They were able to build, you know, alliances with people who were not theologically minded necessarily, but were very committed to questions of social justice and transforming the present, right? Now, what we all know, religious or not, is that, you know, often social change is very hard to pursue. Progressive social change often receives backlash. And I think one of the interesting things about liberation theologians that I mentioned in the portion I just read is that there was this background of faith and hope that nurtures, you know, the believer in the experience of defeat. And there's actually good research on this and how, you know, like this feature of nurturing the faith and hope behind religious believers is immensely important when one is facing backlash, resistance, oppression, because these are hard, you know, pursuits. It's often one is defeated, you know, the idea that one once executed, you know, last briefly or don't last at all. So I think that that's an important element at a very practical, if you will, even instrumental level. Just having that background is important to nurture the struggle.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating how you use Paul Ricoeur and David Tracy in I think that as a framework to talk about these issues, right? To expand the meaning of tradition, but at the same time, to preserve certain boundaries, right? Especially speaking, let's say, in a Catholic framework, right? Now, it's as it's interesting to me that you, for example, you don't use the notion of the church as the body of Christ, right? Because then when you try to address, let's say, systemic problems, my first question is, where do you start? Do you need another system to dismantle a system that is problematic? And the system that comes to mind is the church as the body of Christ, right? Which is, in a way, an enduring system, and with certain flexible and permeable margins. So my question is, why didn't you make more use of this, let's say, framework, this the church as this living organism, which then can be, is the starting point, let's say, of change, of systemic change? Could be the starting point.
Yeah, so the approach of the book and the reason why I guess I don't focus too much on this idea of the body of Christ or the church has to do with my reliance but also commitment to the idea that to think about social justice in the context of pluralistic societies like the U.S., but many of the societies of what we call the West, one has to focus on questions of the basic structure. And this is my reliance, if you will, on roles, but also my commitment to the idea that I think is right. And in that sense, the focus here is to try to understand, you know, the institutions that are at the basic level of organization of society, the constitution, the judiciary, et cetera, the economy, and how these become the conditions that shape everything else, including the church, by the way. So, insofar as that's the focus of the book, thinking about social justice in such a way, the idea was to think then with that focus about theological responses that are capable to address the question of social justice in such fashion. And the responses that I find in liberation theology to this matter are the ones that I think are more productive and enlightened, precisely because this shift to think about the question of poverty and social injustice in terms of, you know, basic institutions, in terms of social justice in the Rawlsian way. Now, and for this reason also, the answers that come from the church will always remain insufficient, right? Because these answers are not really focused on the question of how to think about social justice in pluralistic societies. It is true, as I argue in the book, that after Vatican II, you know, the 60s on, there is a shift to think about the relation between the church and the rest of society in ways that are more productive instead of you know, antagonistic, right? But there is still certain theological and the trinal commitments that don't really help from the perspective of social justice to address certain issues if you're coming just from the perspective of the church. We can think about issues like abortion or same-sex marriage or stuff like that, where certain theological commitments of, say, the Catholic Church are going to collide with questions of, you know, more general social justice. So I think that coming instead from a theological tradition that is more attuned with the question of the basic structure and social justice ends up being, I think, more productive. So I'll start with that. The other issue I was thinking about is that I find the notion of the church as a concept very equivocal. You know, what are we talking about when we're talking about the church? Are we talking about, let's just stay in the Catholic Church because it gets more complicated if you go beyond, but if we're in the Catholic Church, are we talking about the hierarchy? Are we talking about, you know, the production of teaching and documents from the church? Who represents the church? The bishops, the pope, you know, the faithful? There is a massive gap in terms of practice between the teaching of the church and the faithful that has been recorded for decades in service. So who is actually representative of the church? And then you have the notion that you brought up, which is the body of Christ, which is a spiritual notion that has, of course, some practical bearing. But all this just shows shows, I think, that the concept is very equivocal. And I think that equivocity is also unhelpful to think these, in addition to what I mentioned. Now, one can, of course, look kind of inward and see how some of this work on liberation and social justice has to reform and change the church, of course. But that's a task that was different from the task I set to fulfill in the book. So let's start with that, Nate.
Yeah, but then I'm still pondering or wondering what is the framework, right? I understand you want to come to the conversation within a pluralistic context on the one hand. On the other hand, the question is, where do you start to effect social systemic change? And this is my concern, as someone who, let's say, is politically more to the center or center right, where do you start? How do you move? How do you effect that change without being wholesale, without being evasive, right? And that's why it seemed to me that maybe the framework of the church, the Catholic Church, in all its pluralistic embodiments and examples, could be a resource for this. But this being said, the last question is, how do you mediate, let's say, between a Christian faith-based, and I noticed that you speak as a Christian theologian, not as a Catholic theologian, if I understand you correctly. What is the bridge between, let's say, the political discussion role in Martha Nussbaum and the theological discussion, in a way, the first part of your book and the second part of your book? And it seems to me that bridge, correct me if I'm wrong, is what you call the preferential option for the poor. And so I'm putting all of this on the table. Please, pick the thread that appeals to you. Thank you, Raul.
No, this is very appealing. Thank you. So I like your question. This allows me to say a few more things, and maybe I didn't, tap on all the elements of your prior question. But where do you start, right? And I think the question is a fair question. The question doesn't have a clear answer, of course, because I mentioned at the beginning, right, that I'm I was very much shaped and still am by the tradition of American pragmatism. And one of the decisive elements of tradition of American pragmatism is that philosophy, or if you will, more generally, any theoretical inquiry has to be problem solving, because what we do as a species at the end of the day is solve problems of different kinds, right? So in that sense, what I would say is that the experiences that people go through are gonna bring up, the need of where do you start, or are gonna just flag where do you start, right? So this may happen in your parish when you have an experience of a known sexual abuser, for instance, as a priest or something like that. That's an experience of injustice that you have to tackle, and then people may organize and do things to do something about that experience, right? But you may also be part of, work for a corporation, and other people work for a corporation, and you're feeling abused by the treatment and the wages that you receive. And you may start, a union and organize, right? And this is going to be work that you do, and compared to the prior example, probably less connected with other parishioners or people of faith. But you as a person of faith have certain interest in fair treatment as an employee. And you're going to, build bridges with people that may not share the same religious convictions. But here is, the situation where you see different contexts, pointing to where do you start. So this is not a set agenda. It can be within the church. It can be in other contexts. What is interesting to me is the process, a set of articulation of how you get to do something, right? And is the idea here is that it is this strong sense of, a loving God, a God who does not enjoy injustice and is fine with these kind of abuses, right, that becomes the deepest motivation to act in the case of the parish or to act in the case of the union. And then how these things go, these are creative processes that are not, you know, set or preset, if you will. Again, that's another, I guess, partial commitment to the tradition of American pragmatism, is the idea of the creativity of action, right? Things unfold in ways that we cannot really anticipate. Many of these things happen because you have an intuition of the injustice and you want to do something about it. How that ends up, we don't really know, right? So let's start with that. But of course, there's plenty of work to do in the church. The problem, of course, with the church, as we know, not that this is necessarily different in the secular world, but there is different elements at play, is that the church has many incentives to avoid change, right? And I think the theological incentives to avoid change in questions like, I don't know, ordination of women or same-sex marriage or whatever it is, become very difficult or these are elements that make it very difficult to produce change within the church. And I think that's why very often the work of people who are shaped by these liberationist ideas sometimes goes beyond the church to produce social change in other spaces. I have written about this, not so much in the book, but in other pieces that appear after, because you have an issue here, right? The pursuit of social justice within the church, at least currently, has certain limits, and those limits are perceived by many people as very serious and sometimes something that you have to move away from to pursue change in other places or spaces. I say that about that. I very much agree with your reading, and I think that's the key idea, right? That the option for the poor, or to put it more generally, the commitment to social, progressive social change, you know, change that pays attention to the most vulnerable in society, is indeed the bridge between the theological and the political here. And that is perhaps, if we return to my example of unionizing, you know, and trying to organize to receive better treatment from your employees. The idea here is that people are coming to this from different angles, right? I may come to this as a Catholic, you may come to this as a Jew, and this person may come to this as an agnostic, right? But we all have this very strong sense that there is an injustice happening here, an injustice happening to us. I'm going to do something about that. But you can also enter in solidarity, right? There is an injustice happening to them, and you can support that project in different ways, voting, you know, fundraising, etc. So I think this is indeed the bridge that connects people. As I said in the book, the connection or the bridge establishes a connection that marks certain analogies, but not identity, right? I mean, people who are coming from a deep sense of God's justice, for instance, to this unionization process are not the same as people who are coming to this from, let's say, a Marxist perspective. But they can meet somewhere, you know? And I think that's something very powerful about liberation theology, that it was very effective at meeting people where they are and trying to, together, struggle for a better world.
Why do you even then need the theological horizon in this conversation? Why not say, well, we'll have the pragmatist, we'll have Nussbaum's capabilities, we'll have Rawls, his entire theory of justice. Why do we need any theological nuances or concerns to add to this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't need them. I would perhaps frame the question differently. I would say the fact is that you have them, right? People are religious. Many people are very religious. Many of us have theological frameworks operating in the way we inhabit the world. So I'm not making a normative claim saying we need theology to address these matters. I don't believe it. What I believe is that you and I and many others in the world may have theological beliefs through which we see the world. So my task as a scholar, as an academic, is try to figure out how these theological frameworks are operating in the life of people, and how, you know, these theological frameworks may allow us to inhabit a more democratic, a more just world. But in that sense, the question is not normative. It's a from the ground up, if you will, approach, right? Theological frameworks do shape these realities. So my attempt is to understand how and how they could better shape them.
See, and I see your position here. My proposition within this conversation would be, say, maybe, let's say, theology, Christian theology, has some resources in two directions. And I'd be here to, I mentioned it before, I think, especially the Catholic Church as this enduring institution, very pluralistic, very diverse, with a variety of conversations going on, which is an organism and a system, right? It shows that systems are complicated, but systems are not inert. Systems are alive. That's one, I think, resource maybe. The second would be how you define the poor. And that goes towards a question I had for you. Because, you know, in certain aspects of Christian theology, poverty is somehow an injunction, it's a vocation, it's, you know, the ascetical tradition, right? So poverty might not be a problem, but poverty might be a virtue. Now, that is not to say, I'm not making a simplistic argument to tell the poor, well, you're blessed because you're poor. I'm not saying that. But I'm just want to point out to the theological complexity of what poverty is. Right, it's a theological issue as much as it is an economical issue. And herein, I think, theology could provide layers to that could help the conversation be more complex. Right, sometimes in the conversations are just economical, and we see that a lot of times, so the economical solutions are not sufficient. Right, that let's say fulfillment and is more about, let's say, character and virtue and not about economics, right? That is not, I'm not making an exclusive argument. I'm not saying, well, economics is not important.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I think these are, if you will, two different points of entry to the same problematic, right? So what I'm saying is that the way I enter this problem is I just start with a few facts, right? One of them is that people who happen to have theological backgrounds in whatever fashion, you know, might be more sophisticated as a theologian or less, you know, but they have them. They're also people who inhabit the political world, and these frameworks are shaping some of their decisions, right? That's kind of the way I enter this. And through that, I start exploring what theological frameworks are in place. I think this is compatible, slightly different from what you're saying, insofar as, you know, there's of course theological resources in the tradition, rich resources, you know, in the centuries of Catholic teaching, Orthodox teaching, Jewish teaching, and whatever. But an important,
just as a caveat, including the rich trove of the treasury of the teachings about the social teachings, which I think are incredible.
Yeah. Of course, absolutely. But here is an important, I think, difference, which is that one thing is the existence of teaching, right? And one thing is the impact of the teaching in the experience of people. So, of course, you know, my preference is to see how these things are operationalized in the life of people. Now, this is not incompatible with your point, because otherwise one, you know, risks the idea of just being led by whatever people do, and having a critical element coming from whatever tradition. So in that sense, I think we are on the same page. I think there are things in the tradition that might be untapped, you know, and can actually be used to, you know, rethink problems. And as a matter of fact, my argument in the book is that this is exactly what liberation theology does with the question of the poor, right? Goes through the tradition and untaps certain things that were kind of there, but not really materialized in the thinking of 20th century Catholic theology, if you will. So I very much agree with you. My only, I guess, caveat would be I tend to focus a bit more on the way certain things are happening in the experience of people, because otherwise you have certain ideas that are just kind of up in the air and have no connection with how people live their lives of faith. That said, as I mentioned a moment ago, that is not like a definitive judgment, because of course in traditions there are certain elements that can be reactivated and returned and things of that sort. And on the question of the poor, I very much agree. I think one of the a rich element of the Christian tradition, I guess more generally, is to see the problem of poverty as a complex problem, and one that also has certain elements that are aspirational in the sense of virtue, that there is something about a frugal life that is good for the life of the spirit. But I think liberation theologians, Gutierrez particularly, were very clear from the beginning, like never denying this element in terms of the formation of, you know, the self and the spiritual virtue, but always also being very clear that poverty as something that you do not decide for yourself, as something is imposed on you by the circumstances, is always an evil, right? It's different to become, you know, a Franciscan friar and choose a life of poverty as some form of spiritual fulfillment and being forced to be poor by the circumstances. And that distinction is crucial. And it is the second form, the forced upon you poverty, something that is always considered an evil in liberation theology and probably by most of us. And that's the thing that liberation theology is against. I sometimes put it, I don't know if Gutierrez does too, this is a approach that is against poverty, but is for the poor, right? Or with the poor, but against poverty or something like that.
Thank you, Raul. Now, as you were speaking, another question came to mind, and it's related to a dear teacher we share, Professor David Tracy, Father David Tracy. And I found it fascinating how you retrieve both his notion of analogy, but especially his the apocalyptic dimension of theology, right? And I think the way you use this notion of the apocalyptic to qualify and clarify the notion of the revolution, right? Because revolution is a very misunderstood and intentionally so sometimes, right? Because we in the United States see all kinds of revolutions going on, right? And but I think relating the notion of revolution to apocalyptic is very fruitful. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that perhaps the first thing I should say is that there is different meanings to the word revolution or to revolutionary, right? And even though it's common to think when one hears revolution about, you know, like armed conflict and guerrillas and stuff like that, that's actually not necessarily the main meaning of the word. The main meaning of the word is related to radical transformation, right? And I think from that perspective, it's undeniable that what liberation theologians were able to accomplish, not only them, right? There are other things going on at the same time, but it's really a radical transformation of the Catholic tradition and the way it thinks about social justice. I think that's undeniable. I think there is good evidence for that, some of which is in the book. Now, that said, even at that level, let's put aside, you know, armed conflict and all that stuff, it is still like, you know, a big ask, you know, the idea of radical transformation. And here is the thing that I want to explore in relationship to Tracy and his work on the apocalyptic, which is that one of the most interesting things about Tracy, who, by the way, knew Gustavo Gutierrez very well, knows Gustavo Gutierrez very well, and drew a lot from Gutierrez's work for his own work, is that Tracy is so good at reminding us that all these attempts both to understand just the Christian mystery, the Christ event, right, but also to produce transformation in the world, end up being fragmentary, incomplete, you know, always marked, as he says, by plurality and ambiguity. And I think this is very important because this is also something that Gutierrez is very aware of, but perhaps becomes more clear about this over time, that these a dream of radical societal transformation, right? That we're going to live in a more just society is a utopian expectation. And insofar as it is a moral ideal, has power, but I think nobody, or at least now, is so naive to think that this will actually be accomplished in this world. And then the apocalyptic expectation here is important because it introduces this kind of disrupting element, destabilizing elements, like, hey, remember, you know, remember that this is not over here. Hey, remember that the Lord is coming again. And one of the things that Tracy does in his work, and I try to, you know, systematize a bit in chapter 4 of the book, is actually the idea of the second coming of the Lord, which is one of the four symbols that disclose the meaning of the Christian tradition for Tracy, is very much about the concern about the poor. You know, while we await for the coming of the Lord, what have you done with the poorest, the weakest of our brothers and sisters? And I think that that idea is very powerful, very much in line with the concerns of liberation theology. But as in the passage we read before, a cautionary tale, right? It's like, hey, the work is worth doing. The struggle is worth fighting, but it's not supposed to be over here. And this, by the way, I think is a good lesson for religious and non-religious people, because I think religious people are a bit more attuned to this idea because of eschatological beliefs, at least in the Christian and the Jewish traditions. But this is also true in the experience of people who are non-religious, because they will notice that the things they want are not really accomplished. So how do you develop a hope, you know, that is, if you will, secular, but it still can account for the fact of failure and incompleteness? Well, religious traditions like Christianity and Judaism have some eschatological elements, the idea of the apocalyptic, to think about this. I'm sure that there is some alternative resources in secular traditions, but the fact is that the incompleteness of the work of justice is always there.
Maybe as a way to end, I'd like to cite one passage from the chapter Theology on the Ground, which is one of the most fascinating chapters where you actually speak to people who have been involved in different actions, social change. And one of the conclusions you draw here is page 118. Second, maybe I should ask you to read this 118 paragraph starting with second.
Sure, give me 1 second. There we go. Okay, so I can read that paragraph. Okay. Second, while their faith led supporters of liberation theology to pursue political engagement, there was ample room for disagreement and different political affiliations among them. The main reason for this is that most liberation theologist advocates understood that the political was only one area for the manifestation of their commitment to the gospel and the poor. Faith is always more profound and comprehensive than politics. Christians should create the conditions of the advent of the kingdom of God. But ultimately, the kingdom is always a gift, never something that can be produced by us.
This is, I think, a very appropriate and beautiful way to end. But before we go, I'd like to ask you, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, I'm working on several things, but I'm finishing an article that I'm calling Liberation Theology, a Rawlsian Read. And it's my attempt to expand on some of the issues that I noticed maybe were not fully developed in the book and, you know, in presentations and such came up, especially the way in which the Catholic social teaching tradition was not so much addressed in the book, and kind of providing an account of, you know, what is important in that tradition, but at the same time, why I didn't feel so inclined to tap on that tradition to address some of those problems. Some of that I said in this conversation has to do about the basic structure, some of the theological restrictions of the tradition itself. But I think I'm trying to work on a piece that puts that on the table more clearly. And then, but this will take more time. I'm working on the next book project that for now I'm calling Questioning Latinidad. And it's a book about the problem of race, gender, and ethnicity in the context of Latinos in the US especially. But one of the things I'm trying to do is trying to use some of the framework for social justice that I develop in this book to think about this question, trying to navigate, you know, the way in which these conversations tend to be a bit like identity politics focused, and trying to expand a bit the conversation to think about justice in a way that incorporates, of course, issues of racial and gender injustice, but also allows to build, you know, communities beyond that and coalitions beyond that to think about justice in a more comprehensive way, which, by the way, also includes religion in a way I like the argument I'm presenting here, but shifting a bit the subject. So those are, I guess, two projects I can think about right now.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you, Raul. Que te vaya bien.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.